Good evening, everybody. This is your old pal, the Moo Cow, also known as Paul A. Presenza, and welcome to the very, very first podcast episode of Forgotten Horror Classics. So this is a show where we are going to go back and check out some of the great horror movies that have been made over the past 50, 60, 70 years even. But we're going to focus on the ones that have been kind of forgotten or put to the side or just kind of flew under the radar for whatever reason. There's a bunch of them that are out there, and I just thought it was time that we kind of looked at some of those. So tonight I am going to be doing a movie from 1960 that is called Horror Hotel. And with me here in the studio tonight is Miss Lenora Miller.
Hi.
Yay, so you're here and you're going to be checking out the movie with us, right?
Right.
Outstanding. You have been a guest host on Indie Film Cafe a number of times, correct?
Yeah.
I'm sure that has been interesting to say the least.
Yes, it's unforgettable. I'll let you decide for that.
And instead of doing stinky, crappy movies, we're going to go and actually look at a few good movies. So do you like horror films?
Yes.
Outstanding. Have you ever heard of Horror Hotel?
I have not.
All right. Well, then this should be a very interesting experience for you then. So after the break, we are going to come back and we are going to talk about Horror Hotel. Okay, we are back. So, Horror Hotel, what did you think?
It wasn't very scary.
Yeah, I grant you that. But, I mean, come on, compared to some of the movies we've seen, that was a pretty darn good movie, don't you think?
That's true.
Okay, so let me talk a little bit about the film and give folks some background about it. As I said, Horror Hotel was released in 1960. It was first called The City of the Dead when it was released in England, and then it was released in America under the name Horror Hotel in 1961. It was directed by a guy by the name of John Llewellyn Moxie. He was an Argentinian director who actually died this year in April, so he was a long-lived person. He mostly directed British TV and TV movies, and he ended up doing some stuff on American TV as well. In fact, he did 18 episodes of Murder, She Wrote. So he was mostly known for television. I think this and maybe a couple other feature films were the only movies that he actually did. But it's interesting because what I read is that this script, which was written by George Bass, was originally written for TV for Boris Karloff in 1960. And instead, they kind of went in a different direction, but that would have been very interesting. And this was produced by, at the time it was Vulcan, but it was really part of the Amicus production group. This is obviously before your time, but back in the day in England, the renaissance of the horror movie in this early 60s, late 50s, early 60s was mainly by two groups in England. It was Hammer, who did all the famous Hammer horror movies, Dracula and all that, and Amicus. And so this is one of the Amicus productions. The movie stars Dennis Lottis as Richard Barlow, Christopher Lee, the very famous Christopher Lee, as Alan Drisco, Patricia Jewell played Elizabeth Selwyn and Mrs. Newlis in a double role. Betta St. John played Patricia Russell, and Venetia Stevenson played Nan Barlow. So Dennis Lottis was originally born in South Africa. He was really more of a singer. He was in a couple of movies, but he was mostly in a sort of popular band at the time. It's called the Ted Heath Band, and he sang. And in fact, if you look at his Internet Movie Database page, you'll see that he's actually a singer in a lot of these other things. So I think this was one of his very few dramatic roles. And it's kind of interesting because he plays one of the main characters, if not the lead, and I thought he was pretty good. Christopher Lee, this is actually one of his very first films. So before he goes on to become a huge star with the Hammer movies and Dracula and all that, he had this particular role, which was pretty interesting. And, you know, you can definitely tell he's a very good actor, but he's also got that sort of look, that sort of dark look that he brings to the film. See, so Patricia Jessel, who played Elizabeth Selwyn, she was originally born in Hong Kong. She was also in a bunch of TV things. She was in a movie called Model for Hire in 1959. And she was in the BBC production of Hamlet, where she played Gertrude in 1961. She was not really a big star, but again, she did a lot of British television. Betta St. John played Patricia Russell. She was the one who had the book. She, she was in a number of different movies. She's mainly known for some of the Tarzan movies. She was in Tarzan and the Lost Savari in 1957, and Tarzan the Magnificent in 1960, and a whole bunch of other TV things. So she was also probably well known to British TV audiences. Venetia Stevenson played Nan Barlow. She was the young blonde girl, the student who originally came there. She's probably the most famous one at the time. She was like sort of the young actress, ingenue, upcoming actor. She was actually the daughter of director Robert Stevenson, who directed a bunch of stuff in the 30s and 40s. She was famous for being on TV. She played Ricky Nelson's girlfriend in The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet in 1952. And she actually married horror movie actor Russ Tamblyn for a hot minute before they got divorced. She was in a number of movies, including Day of the Outlaw in 1959, The Island of Lost Women in 1959, which wasn't very good, and The Big Night in 1960. She ended up marrying one of the Everly brothers. I don't know if you probably don't know who they are. They were a singing duo in the 60s. She married one of them in 1962, and she pretty much retired from making movies at that point. Later on, she would become vice president of a production company called Cinema Group. And as it turned out, her daughter Erin Stevenson was in the Guns N' Roses video for Sweet Child of Mine, oddly enough. So this was shot in Shepperton Studios, which was sort of like one of the best, if not the only, studio in England at the time. And as I said, it was Vulcan Productions, who pretty much were an amicus group. One of the interesting bits is that in the American release, they censored some of the dialogue that was originally part of the original release of the film in England. Some of the dialogue dealing with Satan and sort of ritualistic stuff. I guess it was a little too realistic sounding for some of the conservative American censors of the day. So that's kind of the background. So I guess we could talk a little bit about the plot, but did you have any questions about any of the background?
No, not really.
Okay. Yeah, this is probably, because you're only 20 years old, this is probably kind of new to you. But for those of us who are movie hounds, as it were, some of these names are definitely familiar. So yeah, the movie itself, it's kind of a witchcraftian kind of horror movie. It's more long on atmosphere and short on horror, perhaps. But it's about this particular student, who's Nan Barlow. She is taking this witchcraft course from one of her professors. He advises her to go to Whitewood, which is this little town in the middle of nowhere in upstate Massachusetts, where she can go and research her final term paper and get some interesting background on witchcraft. She goes there and she gets a lot more than she bargained for and pretty much vanishes. And then her brother, who's the Richard Barlow, played by Dennis Loftus, and her boyfriend, Maitland, decide they have to come and find her. They track her down to Whitewood. They bump into Patricia Russell, played by Betta St. John, and her father, who is the reverend at the abandoned church. And they go through a whole bunch of different things, and it just ends up in this sort of very strange, very broody, gothic, atmospheric climax. So, as far as things like horror and violence and gore. There isn't really any gore in this particular film. The violence is kind of minimal, although some of the scenes are quite, I don't know, stylistically shot. You know, there's one point with the witches are going to look like they're going to be stabbing Nan.
And then they cut to the birthday cake.
Like, immediately. You know, that was pretty well done. She's, like, right in mid-scream. And so that was pretty jarring.
And then they cut to the birthday cake and everyone's singing.
Right. So that was pretty cool. And there were a number of other things. There's a lot of really, I thought, fairly genuinely creepy scenes and creepy moments in there. What did you think? Did you see anything that was kind of creepy or off-putting?
The whole tone, kind of, and I'm pretty sure the boyfriend was named Maitland.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure the guy he met. No, it wasn't Maitland, was it? No, it was the daughter, the granddaughter of the Reverend. I'm pretty sure she met Satan on the road, because it didn't look like Jethro. It looked like someone else.
Okay, so just as a little bit of background, you're referring to Jethro. At the very beginning of the film, there's sort of a flashback to Elizabeth Selwyn, who is getting burned at the stake. And they're doing the whole sort of traditional burn witch, and they're dragging her to the stake. And at one point they stop and they look at this tall gentleman and then they say, Jethro, whatever your name is, have you had, you know, consortions with the Satan? And they look at her and he's like, no. So
why would you say yes?
Right. So they continue to drag her to the stake and they chain her to it and they light her on fire. Meanwhile, he's there with the rest of them and he's going, you know, save her, Satan. You know,
out loud for some reason in the crowd. I'm sure can hear him.
Well, they're all busy screaming for blood. So, you know, and so it's interesting because, you know, and there was another really cool moment because, you know, right when you think, okay, she's going to get lit up, then this really dark shadow falls over her and then it falls over everybody in the crowd. And you're thinking, wow, is there going to be a big storm? Is Satan reaching his scaly arm to go and save her? And again, boom, instead of actually seeing anything, the director cuts it so you're right to Christopher Lee because he's actually been telling the story the whole time. And yeah. I thought that was a very effective transition as well. But our old buddy Jethro pops in, and as it turns out, there are a number of characters who are immortal, and during the exposition part of the film, they discuss where part of the pact with Satan is that they've allowed certain characters who have made whatever sacrifices are appropriate to become more or less immortal. So Elizabeth Selwyn is now the proprietor of the Ravenwood Inn as Mrs. Newley, and Jethro is still pretty much there, although he's creepy. He kind of haunts the road, right?
Yeah.
And several travelers show up there at the crossroad, and he asks to get in, and, you know, he's kind of like, are you going to Whitewood? And, you know, just kind of begs a ride. And when he's in there, he's sort of talking to them in a sort of a creepy kind of manner. And the same thing happens. He shows up at Whitewood, and then they turn to look at him, and poof, he's gone.
Yeah. The third time, it didn't look like Jethro. It looked like someone else, because he said, not many people see me.
Right. And it's funny, because when Maitland drives up, you're all kind of expecting the same thing. He gets to the woods, the crossroads, but instead of Jethro, you're actually seeing Elizabeth Selwyn burning at the cross, or at the stake, and laughing, and it startles him, and he loses control of his vehicle, and that's why he ends up crashing. So that was kind of interesting. But yeah, so in addition to haunting people's cars, he also floats around in the background, and he's consorting with Mrs. Newley about the different festivities, because it's time for them to make their normal yearly sacrifice. So there's the Candlemas Eve on February 1st, which is the time when Nan Barlow's there. And then several weeks later, it's the quote-unquote Witch's Sabbath, which is probably some famous date. I don't know what that is. But that's when Patricia Russell and Professor Barlow are there, which is, you know, you have to have them there. You would like to think that they would rather do that on a day when there's not somebody from out of town there to mess things up, which is, I suppose, is why they did what they did to get rid of Maitland.
Oh, wait, I think the Sabbath would be March 3rd, because they said it's about a month after February 1st.
Okay.
And that makes sense with the sign and everything.
Sure, sure. And then there's another character, Lottie. She's kind of a maid, but she's mute, so she can't talk. But she seems to know exactly what's going on, and a number of times she tries to sort of warn Nan and then warn others. And unfortunately for her, Mrs. Newley always seems to get her just as she's about to make a warning. Although she does do that one thing, that one key thing where she gets Nan's locket. Because remember, Nan was, when she's reading from the book, and that's how Nan ends up getting more information. She ends up meeting Patricia Russell because she's got the bookstore there. That, remember, she's there. She's actually the granddaughter of the Reverend. She's got all the old books, and she borrows the book from there, and she's reading it, and she says, you know, Candlemas Eve, they sacrifice a young woman, and they replace her with a dead bird and a sprig of woodbine, and they sacrifice her using an object that's a personal effect from the victim. And Nan's locket goes missing. So right then and there, we, the audience, see what's going on, but poor Nan.
Oh, yeah, that scene was very on the nose.
Absolutely.
They might as well have just put a neon sign pointing at the Miss Nula saying, bad person.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's one of those things where, like I said, we, the audience, are kind of powerless. We see what's happening. We like Nan. We don't want anything bad to happen to her, but she hasn't quite connected the dots yet. But the thing about Lottie is that she actually recovers the locket and is able to slip it to Miss Russell, and then Miss Russell ends up bringing it back to the brother, Professor Barlow, and that's the sort of catalyst that gets him down in the first place. So even though poor Lottie doesn't quite make it... And as a matter of fact, there are a number of characters who don't quite make it. And that's kind of scary, too. Like I said, Nan Barlow, she's the main focus of the film in the first third of it. And she's this sort of young, pretty, intelligent character that we're sort of following. And it's kind of assumed that we'll be following her throughout the movie. But no, she's the first victim and is killed. What did you think of that? Were you expecting that?
I feel like I should have expected it, but no, I was expecting her to get away.
Right. Because typically that's usually what happens, especially for sort of the heroine of films like this. You know, they get scared, they get frightened, they usually have to have a man pick them up and carry them around or save them. But normally they survive. Not in this case. So that's kind of, you know, a hint that this movie is kind of like not messing around. They're playing for keeps. Whatever witchcraft-involved stuff that these folks have gotten into, clearly this is not some superstition. This is in earnest. And they're taking it very deadly seriously. So that's kind of the plot. I didn't want to get too much into the details because I'd like for folks to go out and see these movies and you know, rent them, etc. Own them if you can, because they're really, really worth it. So I don't want to give away too many spoilers. So let's talk a little bit about the tone. You mentioned the tone.
The tone was surprisingly effective. Like, the town felt claustrophobic and tiny, and it being in black and white, I think that helped the tone too.
Right. So it's got this sort of dark, brooding, gothic, black and white shot. The very high contrast. The darks are very dark. The whites and lights are very, very bright. So you end up getting a lot of shadow play that falls all over the place. And if you're lucky, and see, unfortunately, there are a lot, since this movie is in the public domain, you get a lot of crappy versions of this. That particular version that I have, even though it's not been cleaned up or digitally enhanced, it's still good enough that you can see quite a lot of it. And it was actually beautifully shot. So I would love to see somebody do a Blu-ray version of this where they've gone in and cleaned up sort of all the old scratches and pops and such. I think it would make the movie really, really stand out. But did you also notice every time they go anywhere, it's always dark. It's like you never see daylight.
The fog, too.
And the fog is omnipresent. And it's not just sort of rolling around the ground. It's also, it's up on the roofs, too. Did you notice that? And the graveyards. And the sets were really cool. I mean, the sets looked really, really like 17th century wooden New England, you know, built from scratch.
Yeah.
I mean, it was, it's, I don't know if, I guess they built, they probably built that set at Shepperton. But a lot of detail went into this production and into the sets and into the background. A lot of details, which I thought was really cool. And that just kind of adds to the verisimilitude of it. So that, I mean, it's, you know, we're living in modern times. So, of course, we're not going to believe in witchcraft and Satan and all that kind of a thing. But, you know, when you're seeing an effective, scary tale, you sort of allow your, you suspend your disbelief and allow the story to sort of tell. And that's where good production values will help with that, because it makes it look realistic. It doesn't look stupid or silly. Everything was very professional.
Yeah.
The one thing I did have, well, there were a couple little quibbles I had. One was probably the very modern, quote-unquote, soundtrack for 1960s. Now,
yeah, it's very bouncy and jazzy.
Yes, it was definitely premier 1960s jazz. So, you know, I almost expected the Girl from Ipanema to break out. Most of that was in either dance scenes or in car scenes where they're traveling.
Yeah, well, I guess it does work. I took a history of jazz course a few years ago for college credit, and one of the things that it covered very thoroughly is the ties with jazz is history to Satan.
There you go. That's interesting. So what is that connection?
I forgot some of the details, but in general, a lot of the early jazz players, especially jazz guitarists, would claim they got their musical abilities from Satan by meeting him at a crossroads.
Oh, yeah, like Robert Johnson. He's a bluesman. So, yeah, I had known that as far as blues, but I didn't know that that carried over to jazz as well.
Yeah. And for some reason, plates of tamales make a lot of appearances in this mythos of jazz for some reason. I think it's just the location.
Interesting.
But apparently, if you want to be a jazz musician, the key is to bring a plate of tamales to a crossroads.
Okay. Well, and definitely Crossroads figures into both blues and jazz, and certainly, you know, American mythology, and European as well.
Yeah, blues, jazz, and then rock and roll later on.
Right. You know, it's always one of the old mythological tropes that you bury a vampire at the crossroads because it's a cross, and therefore they're not going to be able to rise from the dead. And I know that in Europe they would bury criminals or those who were convicted of murder and were hung, were also buried at the crossroads, presumably also as a means, a sort of superstition to ensure that they weren't going to cause more malefaction. So that's kind of interesting, and a lot of stuff was happening at that crossroad right before you get to Whitewood, and which is why Jethro kept popping up there.
Yeah. I wonder who the guy at the gas, was it a gas station or a convenience store?
There was a gas station, yeah.
I wonder if he's tied into it somehow.
I got the impression he was kind of an innocent bystander. He was far enough outside of the circle of Whitewood that, you know, he clearly doesn't trust it. He's been saying, everyone who goes there, he's like, you don't want to go there. Nobody goes to Whitewood. They don't like strangers there, and you probably should go somewhere else. But he doesn't know enough to say, it's full of witches and it's cursed. They're going to kill you.
That's true.
You know, the police end up going and interviewing him, and he again, gives them just enough information to be useful, but not enough to sort of clue anybody in into the whole supernatural design of it. So Christopher Lee's character, Professor Alan Driscoll, he's kind of the catalyst who starts the whole plot when he sends Nan Barlow off to do research at a town where he knows there's full of witches. He knows that they're going to need a sacrifice for Candlemas Eve. So he sends her that way. And, you know, when the brother and the girl and the boyfriend show up and, you know, he's sort of putting them off and poo-pooing everything and saying, oh, you shouldn't bother, and she's probably gone off to do more research or blah, 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 blah. And then he's sort of staying behind, and I kind of got the impression they were someplace like Boston or something, one of the universities there. And then it isn't until later, towards the end of the film, where he actually shows up there in Whitewood. You didn't actually see him travel there. He was always back in Boston, where he's like sacrificing doves to some kind of... Yeah, ugh, that was creepy. Yeah.
I'm going to assume that they're at Miskatonic University.
Perfect. Someplace in Boston or Connecticut, something like that. And but he shows up towards the end of the film as part of the group that's there for the sacrifice. And then I believe in one scene when Richard is going through the graveyard, you see one of the stones, says Alan Driscoll.
Why didn't he change his name? Or did he just think he was far enough away from the town that it didn't matter?
I'm pretty sure that's exactly what it was. He wanted to keep his name, and he felt he was far enough away, whereas Elizabeth Selwyn stayed right there, so she had to change her name, and that's why she became Mrs. Newley. But I figured when he was in Boston or Miskatonic or wherever he was far enough away that nobody was going to be the wiser.
Yeah. Speaking of the people who stayed in the town... If they knew the crosses in the graveyard were their weakness, why didn't they destroy them?
Because I believe they were inferring that all of them had some kind of a pact with Satan. And
so they couldn't enter the graveyard?
I believe so. And that's one reason why the priest or the reverend was still there. And even though he didn't have a parish, he wanted to make sure that the church was occupied and wasn't burned down or desecrated or... You know what I mean? It was like the last bit that was still sacred, and the graveyard, by extension, would also be sacred to the church as well. And so if he's there and he's protecting it, even though they take his sight away and they scare him, and clearly he's a very frightened old man, but he stays there anyway. And it's sort of unsaid, but his wife, which is the grandmother of Patricia Russell, you wonder if they killed her.
That's true.
Because she says that the mother died, quote unquote, and so that's why Patricia's there to sort of take over. But you have to wonder if that's part of their plan, was to try to drive out the old reverend, and this was one of the things they were going to do.
Either drive her out or draw the granddaughter in.
Mm-hmm. Well.
Or both.
I think. My impression is that the granddaughter being there was more happenstance, and it was something that they wanted to use to their advantage, but they would love to have driven out the reverend, and so they could get to the church, desecrate it, and it would no longer be a sacred spot, and then they could probably get into the graveyard and get rid of all the crosses.
So, secondary question. They couldn't enter, but when they threw a dagger... Wait, this would probably be spoilers. But the dagger they threw could get into the graveyard just fine, and it had impact. Why couldn't they just toss a torch in one day?
Well, I don't know. Maybe not all of the crucifixes are wooden. The one that Maitland picks up and uses is. But the impression I got is there were a lot of headstones, and there was a lot of other stonework there as well. So yeah, they may have been able to get rid of a couple of wooden ones, but not the stone ones.
Oh, I guess that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's not... Maybe I'm thinking or putting more into it than the writers originally thought. But, it seemed to make a lot of sense, as long as you're willing to suspend your disbelief and believe in witchcraft and Satan and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because they were clearly doing some kind of black mass that was, as they keep saying, was in mockery of... God's mass and blah, blah, blah. But there was a lot of singing and a lot of chanting. And part of it was kind of cool, but also it was kind of creepy, too.
Yeah.
And it was creepy that it was all coming from under the floor.
Oh, yeah, that was creepy.
I mean, can you imagine staying at a creepy hotel and in the middle of the night you hear stuff coming from underneath the floor?
happened to me at a hotel, but the house that I used to live in was like that.
Oh dear. Really?
Yeah.
How did that work out?
Well, somebody tried to light the house on fire, so
who knows? Oh, that sucks.
Yeah, they didn't get us. They went to the wrong building.
Okay, well, that's good.
The building they hit was abandoned.
Sorry about that.
I mean, we were okay. No one was hurt.
Sounds like a real horror story.
Yeah.
But one of the cool things was, too, is, and obviously they were using there was a trap door there. And the trap door they used as a way to sort of trap, quote unquote, the people that they were putting in that room, because they were clearly using that, because remember she lied to Nan saying there was nothing there but dirt. And but they must have provided the key. Remember when she... That was creepy, too.
Like, she was trying to figure out how to get in, and then a key on the string.
Right, on the window, and it's creepily tapping against the glass, and you're like, what the hell?
Who did that?
Right. So they provide her with the only key that's going to work for the only trap door going down into the area. So, yeah.
Which seems odd to me, because they could open it from the inside of the tunnel.
They could, but they were messing with her. They were luring her into her doom. So that's what they do. They provide her with the key. They're luring her with the music. She's definitely hearing stuff. So, you know, we are curious creatures. You know, when presented with that kind of opportunity, of course, we're going to open up the trap door. We're going to go down the creepy dark stairs that was loaded with spider webs. Although, funnily enough, she didn't seem to mind them so much, whereas Professor Barlow goes through there and he's like wigging out with the spiders. I thought that was fun. And, you know, just like in the great tradition of old creepy dark house movies, there's lots of, like, moving walls and you know, there was, like, chains on the wall where you think somebody's must have been held, and torches and cobwebs and dark shadows and stuff like that.
I will say that one wall, considering it was made from stone, moved quite silently.
It did.
They must have invested in some really good hydraulics.
Somebody was a very good mason.
Or that. Yeah, I guess it's true.
So that was pretty neat. And that again, is one of the things that contributes to the overall verisimilitude of it. So as far as any bad things, you just didn't think it was scary enough.
Yeah, it wasn't very scary. Also, I have many questions for the Reverend.
What, like what?
Well, if he knew how to defeat them, why didn't he?
I guess because it's considered, you know, he's pretty old and blind, so that's enfeeble. So,
maybe he just couldn't leave the church.
Well, he does very, very briefly, but yeah, I mean, he's the one who ends up providing the answer to Alan or to Barlow, so that he can figure out how to do it. But he's just too old and too feeble to do it himself.
But then why didn't he tell his granddaughter or Nan how to defeat them?
Right.
Well, I mean, he literally locked Nan out of the church.
That's true. But he also says several times that he'd been trying to convince people about what was going on and nobody was listening to him or believing him. So you have to figure based on that. He was telling his granddaughter about all of this, and she was just, like, not paying him any mind. You know what I mean?
I guess that's true.
I'm guessing she was living elsewhere, living her own life until the grandmother either died or was killed, and then she's forced to come back and sort of deal with this, and here's this, you know, strange, feeble, blind grandfather, Reverend, telling her the place is haunted or full of witches that are cursed, and I mean, what are you going to say to that sort of thing? I mean, it's...
That's true.
It's kind of odd. You might not believe it immediately. Although, she does... Remember when she's talking with Barlow, where she says, now I'm beginning to wonder if what my grandfather was saying is actually true. So clearly, he was trying to communicate all this stuff, and nobody was buying it. So, now my question is, as regards to the Reverend, is, I mean, I don't know exactly what denomination he would have been, but could he not have reached out to somebody else, some other church or some other? I'm sure there was a hierarchy someplace, you know? I mean, it looked like it was some kind of high church, some kind of Episcopal or something church. Was there nobody else that he could have written to? Or
called or anything? Because there has to be a way to get mail out, because, well, the granddaughter was able to come in. She had to be informed somehow.
Right. And somewhere along the line, you got to figure, if the church is still active and it's still on a roll somewhere, that maybe they would have sent in a younger reverend. You know what I mean? But I don't really know. I mean, it's probably one of the things about little New England towns like that, that, you know, the reverend comes from the locals. And since there was no pool of locals, since they're all, you know, evil and in on the thing, that he's the last one and that's it. And there was nobody to come in, and that's why he was staying the entire time. You know?
It's true.
I want to talk a little bit about the beginning, where Elizabeth Selwyn is being dragged off and they're doing the whole burn, witch, burn thing. In the early 60s, that was a pretty common trope. There were a lot of witchcraft-related films. That was kind of like a big thing. Previously, witchcraft was kind of sort of snarked at and just not really... It didn't really come up much in the great Universal pictures of the day, like in the 30s or not even in the 40s. There's a little bit, and maybe the Wolfman in the 40s. And, you know, the 50s, they had the atomic monsters and all that kind of stuff, but... It's really in the 60s where the whole idea of witchcraft and Satanism being sort of scary, frightening things, and these are the things that are going to lead later on to things like Rosemary's Baby and The Exorcist and all these other great big films that everybody does know about. But in the early 60s, this was kind of coming back in a big way, and probably the most famous example of this would have been the Barbara Steele movies. Those are not forgotten, so I probably, you know, like Bloody Sabbath and, you know, some of these other really, really great movies, everybody who is a horror film knows Barbara Steele, and that's kind of who Patricia Jessel was playing. She was playing the sort of the Barbara Steele role of the woman getting burned at the stake for witchcraft. That would have been done so either in Italy or Russia or England or other places in some of the other world cinema. And it was very interesting because it's kind of an antecedent, because I think in 1960 that still barely predates some of the Barbara Steele movies, which is interesting. Although most of them, you know, those are also shot in very, very gothic sort of styles. But it was interesting to me to see that. So witchcraft had the, and Satanism sort of had its thing until probably, I think Dracula overshot all of them. So the remake, the Hammer remake of Dracula kind of was a huge phenomenon, and it single-handedly fueled the 60s British film industry and horror industry, and it kind of, you know, while they did some other horror type movies in England, the Dracula kind of blew them all out of the water. So there were a few other witchcraft-oriented films. You know, one of the ones I was thinking about, what's the name of it? There was this really weird one that's about these British bikers who make a pact with Satan, or they actually make a pact with a frog demon, and they're able to get immortality, but this is very strange, very, very sort of steeped in 1960s fashion and music. But other than that, the whole witchcraft thing kind of sort of had its peak in the 60s and Barbara Steele, and then it doesn't really appear until, you know, later in the 70s, and you get Rosemary's Baby and The Omen and that whole thing. And that's more Satanism. Blair Witch is really you've heard of Blair Witch Project, yeah.
Yeah.
That was sort of the movie, I think, that sort of brought back witchcraft. And so now you've got all these independent films, you know, Witch House, and even up to, was the 2016 movie, The Witch. I don't know if you saw that. That was brilliant. Oh, definitely got to see that.
I didn't see it.
Oh, magnificent film. So it's, again, having another little renaissance in film, which is kind of cool.
Yeah.
And again, this was Christopher Lee's first one of his very first roles. That was pretty neat to see. And again, he becomes this international star with Hammer and with Dracula.
Yeah.
It's kind of a shame that most of the rest of these folks didn't really move on to other things. I'm particularly puzzled over the director, John Moxley. He did a lot of stuff with television, but, you know, he directed this film with the kind of attention to detail and patience and skill and craft that I would have expected more, especially out of Abacus, but didn't really happen. You know, he was really more of a TV sort of guy. So you have to wonder if something like this today could be shot. See, I don't think that they could really do it in the same way, because today they would shoot a movie like this and they would make it a whole lot more violent, a whole lot more gory. They would definitely add a lot more sex into it. There'd be all kinds of nudity, most likely. But this film didn't have any of that. And I still thought it was a very, very effective film. You know, more on the broody, gothy, atmospheric thing and less on horror, actual genuine horror, perhaps. But effective nonetheless. What do you think?
Yeah, I'd say it was effective. The effect with when he was lifting the cross and everything, though, was a bit cheesy looking.
When he looked in the cross?
No, when he was lifting it around.
Oh, when he was lifting it.
Yeah, the fire effects were a little cheesy looking.
I thought that was pretty cool. I mean, you know, I liked this, you know, we kept saying the shadow of the cross, and then the guy catches on fire. That was pretty cool, I thought.
It was interesting, but it just struck me as kind of funny almost that the fire was exactly in one straight line, and he had to keep turning to hit the other people.
Well, I presume that's because of the shadow.
Oh.
My question about that is, where's the light coming from?
Was there a full moon?
I get the impression that we're supposed to think that there's a full moon, yeah. I think there was at least one moonshot there, but yeah, you know, I kind of liked it, and you know, it's funny because they're trying to sacrifice Patricia Russell on the headstone, and they're waiting for the 13th strike of the bell. They can't sacrifice her until they hear that.
Apparently, Satan's quite strict about deadlines.
Apparently, it all has to go. Exactly. Well, it's a ritual, and that's the thing. I mean, it's the same
it's
thing
true.
with any kind of religious thing. There's a ritual, this is the way you do it, and you have to do it this way, and if you don't, it doesn't work.
Which leads me to think that whoever it is who maintained that clock must have been one of the most important people in town.
Probably. And plus, you know, I find it interesting because, you know, even Mrs. Newley says, I've never heard a clock strike 13, but... You know, it's 13, of course, is the evil number of Satan, blah, 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 that kind of crap. But, so they're about to sacrifice her, but he's stumbling forward with the cross, but they can't kill her yet. So they're sort of stuck between a rock and a hard place because they need to have the sacrifice in order to continue their pact, but they can't do it until the 13th strike of the bell. In the meantime, poor Maitland, who's dying... is carrying the cross, and the shadow of the cross is lighting all their asses on fire, and they can't do anything about it.
So yeah,
that was kind of cool. It was like they were trapped in their own trap that they set for everybody else.
Actually, another question: if nobody really goes into the town, and all the people in the town, with the exception of the Reverend, are in the cult, where are they finding two girls a year to sacrifice?
Interesting question. And I think that is the catalyst for both Drisco to send Nan Barlow, but probably it's the reason why he has these lectures in the college in the first place.
Oh, that's true.
Is to probably get young, impressionable college kids interested in such things, maybe sort of mold one or two to his way of thinking and sort of get them very interested. And then send them on their way where they're not going to know any wiser. You know, not going to be any wiser. And they end up being victims.
You'd think, though, that the pattern would emerge soon enough that the police could have their eye on him.
Yeah, and you would think that they would probably have some other way of getting people in there as well. But, again, the movie is focused on this length of time. And we're not really meant to think about, you know, how they managed to create sacrifices over the last 200 years. Clearly, they were able to find enough people somehow. And then somebody like, my question is, apparently there are other people there, whether they stay there or not. I mean, Lottie was not one of them. She knew about it. They threatened her.
Yeah.
And you get the impression that she was there because she had nowhere else to go. I think one of the first threats that Mrs. Newley says is, you know, we've told you before, you know, if you interfere, we're going to throw you out and you won't have anywhere to stay. And you know what that means. She could be another victim. But I guess because she was mute and kind of, I don't want to say dumb, but servile, that they found utility in her for cleaning up and, you know, doing all the sort of stuff that they don't want to have to do. And, you know, maybe they were going to use her as a sacrifice at the last, you know, if they had nobody else. But then she knew about it, so for whatever reason, or maybe because she was mute, she wasn't a good enough sacrifice to Satan. Maybe he's, you know, got certain specifics. I don't know. I didn't read too much into that. But, yeah, it's pretty interesting. So what else do you have to say about the film?
Not much. Just that I thought the Shadow of the Cross scene was funny because he had to keep turning.
He did. He did have to keep turning and dragging it.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's just one of the things. Back in 1960, it would have seemed a lot more dramatic then than now. What are you going to do? Yeah. We're dealing with a subject that I think, at least I like to hope, that we pretty much all understand that it's just for entertainment purposes only. You know, again, reigniting the whole idea of witchcraft being scary was kind of newish in 1960.
Yeah, it seems like it continued into the 80s.
Yeah, but it was a very, very interesting film, I thought. And again, it's a movie that I would bring up to some of my friends and they'd be like, who? What? Where? What? I first saw this film way back in the day when I was growing up in the 70s and 80s. And I was a kid, and this was before cable. And they would have local TV shows, local TV stations, and in order to keep people interested, they would do monster movies. So you would have like Creature Double Feature, and you would have, you know, Dr. Shock, who was a horror host, and you could sit there and watch three or four horror movies in an entire Saturday, and sometimes they do them late night as well. And a lot of them were just really neat, kind of old movies. Now, a lot of them were crappy movies, which is where I got my love of stinky movies from. But every now and again, you'd get a movie like this, and that's kind of one reason why I fell in love with horror films, because you're right, even though it's not particularly scary, it's a very broody, gothy, cool movie, I always thought. And so I've always really enjoyed it, and I always wanted to talk to it with my other friends, and they all knew Dracula and Frankenstein and The Mummy and all that, but I don't think very, very few of them ever saw this film. So it was kind of a shame. So I hate to think that it's sitting out there in oblivion. I would love to see people watch it. As I've said, it is in public domain, and I do know that if you get some of the cheap DVDs that are out there, the sort of DVD collections of public domain movies, it will pop in there from time to time, although the quality level ranges from passable to absolute crap, unfortunately. I would love to see someone like Kino Lorber or some other group take it in and clean it up and release it in a Blu-ray. I think it's long past time. And I just think it's a very, very cool sort of, gothy movie.
Yeah.
So
it did remind me of that painting, the one with the farmer and his wife in front of the building.
Oh, American Gothic?
Yeah.
Definitely. Definitely. All right. Well, I guess we've probably talked enough about this particular film. So, with regards to Forgotten Horror Classics, what the plan is to do this once a month. And we're going to have Miss Lenore with us for the first few episodes.
Hi.
Yay. And I'm going to see if I can't maybe dig up one or two more movies that might be a little more scary for you. Yeah, it's hard. You know, it's hard to really do that in a modern, you know, in 2019 to sort of see it. Because we've all seen it all before. And
even if you haven't seen this movie, there are enough tropes that other movies have borrowed from movies like this that you've seen it all before.
You know? Yeah. Although, I will say, I do like a lot of The Corpse Bride or Nightmare Before Christmas. I like those movies. I have a lot of childhood memories associated with them.
Oh, yeah. Those are pretty decent. Unfortunately, I wouldn't call them forgotten. Most people know those movies. They're pretty mainstream.
I know.
Yeah. Not that that's necessarily a bad thing. But yeah, for this. For this particular show, we're going to focus mainly on the forgotten ones, or the ones that very few people have seen, or perhaps they saw it at one point but just either forgot about it or it just kind of went over their heads. So that's kind of what I'm doing, is digging them up and talking about them. So we're going to do that more in the show, and hopefully when we get this up on Podbean, I'll probably make some kind of a website for it, and I'll put links on there, and I'll do a little research, and I'll see if I can't put information there so that people who would love to get a copy of it, or either that or watch. I'm sure you can see it on YouTube. You know, that's sort of one of those modern conveniences which are useful. But if you're like me, I really love to have the physical medium, because then I can control it. I can do whatever I want with it. It comes with me. Nobody can take it away. And I can show it or watch it whenever I want. So I'm always going to look for a place where I can buy it. And I know that there are other people out there too. So I'll dig around and see if I can't find some places where they're still selling it. Especially, like I said, if I can do a little research and it turns out that there's a Blu-ray copy of this where it's been cleaned up and restored, that would be fabulous. Most of these movies that we're going to do are going to probably be older films. There are a few in the more modern era, 80s and 90s, that are also kind of forgotten or overlooked, that I want to do as well. But I did remember you did say you watched old movies, and that you said with your grandfather, was it?
No, he was a family friend.
Oh, a family friend.
Yeah. He was kind of grandfatherly, though.
Okay. And he introduced you to old horror movies?
Yes. Well, I guess they were mostly sci-fi, weren't they? But he did introduce me to old movies.
Okay. Well, I think we'll probably, while we've got you here for the next few months, is we'll probably concentrate on some of the older black and white films, and I think you'll like some of them.
Okay. I'll let you know if I remember any, because I was like 5 when I saw them. I saw his whole collection.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you say they were mostly science fiction movies?
Mm-hmm. Like B-rate 50s science fiction.
Oh, yeah? Like what? Like Earth versus Flying Saucers, anything like that?
Yeah, I do remember very distinctly this one movie where the set had, like, the ground was cloth for some reason, but they had this saucer, and there was, like, a police officer and somebody else talking about it while in front of it, and then they hit it, and it has a very high-pitched, odd noise for metal, and they say, yeah, that's not natural.
That almost sounds like an Ed Wood movie. Was that Plan 9 from Outer Space by any chance?
It might have been. It might have been Mars Needs Woman.
Oh, well, Mars Needs Woman was color. I've got that as well. I can dig that up.
No, it wasn't that then. Might have been Planet 9 from Outer Space.
Planet 9 from Outer Space is a classic. I pretty much know that one. And at some point, we will probably cover that for Indie Film Cafe. And as a matter of fact, I do believe that Forgotten Horror Classics is going to show up in relation with Indie Film Cafe and Cyclic Productions, so... when you come and you check out Forgotten Horror Classics, please go and check out the stinkier side of old horror movies with Indie Film Cafe and newer ones. And definitely check out Sick Flick Productions, where we are making short films and podcasts and feature-length films, and check some of those out as well. All right, Miss Lenore, I think that is it for tonight. Any final words about the film you'd like to say?
I don't think I'd want that particular reverend as my reverend. He doesn't seem like he gets a whole lot done.
Well, let me ask you this. Would you recommend this to somebody who is interested in horror films?
Yeah, I'd say so.
Okay, very good. I would do the same. I think it's a very atmospheric, cool kind of movie to put on. Maybe very creepy. Light on the horror, I'll give you that. Some inappropriate music, I'll give you that. But overall, I'd think it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we are signing off here from Forgotten Horror Classics, and we will catch you next time.
Bye.
Bye.